Well, hey.
Hey, man.
Cheers.
Wait.
Oh yeah, got a top off.
Jake, my friend, cheers.
Cheers.
Clink. Boink. Did you know that a year ago today was when we released the Matrix versus Batman and Robin episode?
I got an alert online, a memory.
Yeah, me too. I'm like, wow, that was a year ago. Well, so we should be better at saying to our listeners, welcome to Sippin' Mimos.
You know, I like it, but it's just kind of like, I kind of like the whole improv vibe, you know, like we don't really know what's going to happen on an episode of Sippin' Mimos.
Yeah, it's loosey-goosey. It's loosey-goosey. But this is a show where Jake and I talk about 90s electronica and 90s radio rock, often while sipping beverages.
Often while sipping citrus-based libations.
Truly. but we kind of gave up on the Mimo thing pretty quick because I haven't had a mimosa on the show in a long time.
You know what? Like, maybe we can... I'm right there with you, but because it's a lot of times it's like a whole thing, you know, you got to go to the corner store and you buy a whole thing orange juice. I'm like, well, I don't know if I'll finish all that orange, you know, so.
What? The finishing the orange juice is the least of your concern. You put that in the fridge. It's breakfast juice, baby.
That's true.
Do you think sipping Mimos and like if people like are like, oh, mimosas, is that is like a breakfast podcast? Do you think that's hurting our numbers? Is it about breakfast?
Man, that's a good point.
We might have fucked up with the title of the show a long time ago. We could have called it 90s cast, blah blah blah. But like it's not Sippin' Mimos. Because we were dead set on that.
We were like that was like one of the first conversations we had about this thing. We're like, that's the name of the episode.
Yeah. Well, I'm a fan of the name of the show, so we're not changing it at all. I don't give a shit.
I like that. If you are here, you know, please tune in next time where I will give my famous recipe for a sweet potato hash with paprika and hatch peppers. So.
Wait, that sounds awesome.
It's actually really good.
Wait, sweet potatoes? I'm not a sweet potato guy. Can you think you could change me? You could convert me?
I feel like because like with paprika and the peppers, you can do some onion in there. Some tomatoes. It's just like it's more if you can get down with like the sweet potato texture, which might be a little different from like a regular. It's pretty good. Like this, it all mush it all together and make a really nice hash.
I've never been a big sweet potato guy. Like you know, Thanksgivings and all that, and then like sweet potato fries. Like they sometimes put like cinnamon on it, I think, or even like I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if I'm into that.
I don't know if I can get down with cinnamon. I will get down with Wingstop's fries. They put sugar on them.
On the fries.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Hillertown.
Have I never had Wingstop? This is weird. I don't think I have.
We need to do an episode. When we eventually get in person, we can do an episode where we like scarf some wings and talk about like Paul McCartney's band Wings.
That's exactly how I would do it. Oh, that's so funny. have you seen Hot Ones, the Hot Wings show on YouTube and all that?
I've never seen a full episode because
you have to check it out.
They're like you know usually like 20-30 minutes, but I've tuned in for like clips and I love the one with Elizabeth Olsen. I thought that was great.
Uh huh.
And she I think she like went the distance.
Yeah. The other day, I don't know, I tore through a bunch of Mwambas like doing stuff, but like it's kind of like a you can watch it or you can like keep it on the background kind of thing. But it's so fun to watch these people just like once they hit like wing 6 or 7, they're just like, okay, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, and they start freaking the hell out. It's great.
Didn't Elijah Wood do one recently? And
yeah, he talked about Austin a lot.
That's what I heard. Like someone tweeted about it, but I think he still lives here.
He's got a place here. Yeah. I know where it is. If you ever want to go and like hunt him down.
Let's talk after the episode.
Yeah, we'll keep that off mic. But no, anyways, like talking about like, oh, you got to get this food truck for breakfast tacos in the South first. You got to go to Ramen Tatsuya and all this. And then you go to Alamo Draft House for movies and blah, blah, blah. Like, he's like a big, he's you know, Alamo Draft House here in Austin. He's like a big, he knows, you know, the owner, and like he friends with him, like, and does the, I don't know if it's they have different festivals all the time, like Butnumathon, where you stay in the theater for like 3 days or, and then there's another one. I don't know.
Is it Fantastic Fest?
Fantastic Fest. Thank you, Jake. Where it's like a week long of like movies that aren't released yet that are just going to be fucking crazy and weird and all that.
I've always wanted to do that. I remember 1 year, Tom DeLonge from Blink 182, which.
Who?
Tom DeLonge. Of the log of Linkway 2, which see our episode on Enema of the State, and to know to learn of my obsession with him and Blink 182. He produced a movie called, I think it was called Love or something like that, and it premiered at Fantastic Fest, and I went because, you know, I wanted to, you know, meet him and say hi, and there were people there like who were part of his like fan club, and they were like, yeah, like we're told to be here like at 3 because we're gonna do something. Well, the movie was about space, and
no,
like, they had these two peeps like put like spacesuits on and like walk in with Tom DeLonge. And I wanted to be them so bad, like so they were like orange like Armageddon spacesuits, like it was awesome. Speaking of movies,
yeah,
anything good lately?
I don't even know if I've seen anything. Oh, I watched, okay, all right, I went over to my brother's place to watch the fourth and final Evangelion rebuild movie.
Okay,
Jake, are you familiar with Evangelion?
No.
Evangelion's like a classic, I guess now classic anime, like very popularized in the 90s, about like giant robots versus these alien creatures, but they are these monsters that are referred to as angels. And there's this vast mythology. And when I was a kid in high school and like getting into anime, like this is the dopest shit ever. Like reinterpreting the these ancient texts into this story thing where, like, okay, the angels are coming to Earth to destroy us. And so what we better do is build giant robots, and then put little kids inside, and the kids have to like become the robots and then beat the hell out of them. But there's like so much more, and it's so weird and fucking wild. And it's mostly about the end of the world and all that. But it's so fucking dope. If you're like big robots, if you like monster fights, and you're into like deep weird mythologies as I am, I can't recommend Evangelion, Neon Genesis Evangelion, enough. It's so fucking cool.
Awesome. It kind of sounded like you were describing like Pacific Rim. Was that an influence on Pacific Rim?
The Pacific Rim, Guillermo del Toro insists that no, Evangelion had nothing to do with this, but it's kind of there. It's yeah. Kind of the same idea. Yeah, kind of the same idea.
Yeah. That's cool, man. See, that's one of the things that it's kind of like the works of like a director I haven't really seen like a ton of, or an actor. Like a lot of like the like Cary Grant movies or Lauren Bacall, those like great early like golden age of Hollywood actors. Like there's, I know there's a wealth of material there that I know that I will get to eventually, and I'm very much looking forward to that, you know. But like I feel with a lot of like our show, we kind of see like how where we are in our lives, like music tends to just like kind of like connect where you are emotionally, you know. And I know that eventually, you know, I will like discover this anime world, and I know that there's just so much to dive into, and I'm really looking forward to that. And I know. I know you're a really big fan. Every time we talk about it, you make it sound like the coolest thing in the world. So, I think it's gonna be awesome. But I haven't dived in yet, but need to.
Wait. Is there an anime you've gotten into before? You can just say no. It's fine.
No, I mean, no. I watched. Would like Pokemon be considered?
If you like, yeah, sure. And anime is not a genre. The anime is like it's just the Japanese word for animation. So it's not like a.
Oh, okay. Then yeah, I guess like Pokemon would. Back in the, I remember Pokemon used to like. It was the most inconvenient thing in the world. It came on at like 6 a.m. where I was in San Antonio.
And 6 a.m.
6 a.m. 100%. And I remember I had two buddies who were always up at 6 a.m. because like I think their parents had to be up and they got dropped off at school real early. And me, like, I lived very close to school, so I didn't need to get there at a certain time. So like I would get to school and they'd be like, "Oh my gosh! And did you see when Bulbasaur did this?" And I'm just like, "Oh, you know, like so." Like I would tell my mom, I'd be like, "Mom, can you wake me up at 6 a.m. so I can watch Pokemon?" And she'd be like, "Okay."
Wow! Oh my god! Wait, so you would watch Pokemon before going to school?
Mm-hmm. Well, I should say it happened once. My mom woke me up one time, and I was so sleepy that I didn't even catch anything. And I was just like, you know what? This isn't meant to be. It's all right.
Yeah. I'm not setting an alarm for anything like that. Okay.
It was a trip. What I mean, man. Me though, I've been watching kind of same like animation. And I'm kind of obsessed with it. What If on Disney Plus?
I haven't seen What If yet.
Okay.
But I understand the first episode is what if it was Carter that got the superhero serum, and then the second episode is what if T'Challa was Star-Lord?
Yes.
But I did watch Black Widow.
Oh, you saw it?
I did, yeah.
What are your thoughts?
I don't say Black Widow is like, I was just kind of like, okay. Like, they're not advancing the story, clearly.
Yeah.
So, that was a weird move. I don't know why they did Black Widow like that after, after Far From Home. It's an odd maneuver, I guess, to say like, oh, write out that the Red Room's done and we might have a new Black Widow in Florence Pugh, who I love.
Yeah, I would 100% be okay with that.
I think she's so great. Ooh, I'm on board.
Yeah, I didn't realize it, but she's we probably see her face like once a week in some form of a meme. She's from Midsommar.
Yeah, she's the girl from Midsommar, man. Oh my god, have you seen Midsommar? Midsommar?
I haven't seen that one. I know.
Oh boy.
I know it's the same folks that did like Hereditary, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hereditary was scared the bejesus out of me.
Yeah.
And so like I'm kind of worried to see it.
Yeah. Like, it's really fucked up and scary. But she's like astounding in it, so I'm on board if she's like going to replace, Scarlet as like the new Black Widow. I'm done with that. But then
doesn't Midsommar have Chidi from Good Place in it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've talked about this before. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did we talk about this?
Yeah, I think we have
on the pod on the episode.
I think so. On the show. I think we have. Yeah, 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 yeah. But Florence Pugh. I'll never know how to say that name. P-U-G-H.
Flo Pew. But no, I thought she was like, she was like so charming and just such a it was such a joy every time she was on screen, because she was just like, just, you can tell she was having a lot of fun with the role. And
yeah,
I mean, and Rachel Weisz and David Harbour, I mean, I would.
Rachel Weisz. Yeah. And Dave Harbour, like, just acting his ass off, having fun. When he's like doing the arm wrestling thing in the jail.
Yeah.
Like, and that's when I beat up Captain America. And it's like, are you calling me a liar? And like, it breaks that guy's arm. I don't know. That's fun. I'm on board with that. I should rewatch it. I don't know.
And Ray Winston as
yeah, it was Ray Winston. Yes.
Ray doing Winston. Like, is it Winston? I never know if it's Winstone or Winston.
It's probably Winstone. Whatever I'm saying is the wrong way. But that guy rules.
Oh, he was great. I mean, and I forget how much I really, really enjoy, because he was great in. Did you ever see The Departed with Jack Nicholson and Leo?
Yeah, I've seen The Departed, bro.
When he has that really, that great, his accent comes out so good. He just has such little regard for everything. He's just like, he's just, oh yeah. And
keep doing it. Wait. Say our Sip and Mimo's intro in your way, Ray Winston.
So this is my Ray Winston. He's just got this great Irish accent and welcome to Sippin' Mimos. I'm Ray Winston, and you know, this is Jack and Elliot listening to literature while drinking mimosa, but they don't. killer.
No, come on, I love that.
Oh, I'm so glad God. We got that recorded. I wanted to sit back so bad. I thought he was really good. I mean, it was one of those where it probably would have been better served at another point in the series, you know, like, or in one of the phases, but I don't know. I would like to see, I mean, I don't think we'll see him again because I'm pretty sure he died, but I would like to see, you know, Dave Harbour, Rachel Weisz, you know, of course, Florence Pugh, Flo Pugh.
Flo Pugh.
Would definitely like to see them again. And it was cool to see Julia Louis-Dreyfus make her appearance.
Yeah. Seems like with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, they're gearing up for something, because she shows up in the end of
Falcon Winter Soldier
to like start recruiting a what seems like to be a Dark Avengers.
Oh, I didn't pick up on that. Because she picks up Russell.
National Warrior or some shit. You know, they can't call him Captain America anymore or whatever. And she's like, you'll do fine. And then she picks up this alternate Black Widow. And so I think she's going to keep going doing that and like build these Dark Avengers.
That'd be cool.
I think that's totally what it is. Yeah. Seems to be.
But I won't spoil What If, but I've been really enjoying it. Like, it's,
yeah, I'm psyched to check it out. Is the animation awesome? Is it cool? Is it fun?
It's really cool. It reminds me of, did you ever see like those, I don't like, it's not like full blown Scanner Darkly, but like it looks almost like it could have been like mocap, you know, kind of thing. Huh?
The word you're looking for is rotoscope.
Rotoscope.
It's when they trace over every image on a film frame and they just animate it like within Illustrator. So you just like this kind of trace around the shadows and highlights and all that. And then they keep doing that through the frames and then they move together. Rotoscope.
I really dig it. I really, really do. And it's cool to see. I mean, because like Captain America, like the first Avenger, I mean, that came out what, in 2011? Like 10 years ago. So it, I may be wrong about that, but it's cool to see or to hear these voices come back, you know, and really, cause it makes you feel like the actors really care about the role and like really like really like value like that experience. And it just, I don't know, it just, it kind of, it makes it like a very like nice viewing experience, you know, like and I'm not gonna lie, like if it wasn't the Ma Rainey's Black Bottom wasn't like the his official like last role, I don't know if What If is, but like Chadwick Boseman is voicing T'Challa in What If.
Oh yes, okay, that was my question. Yeah, is it amazing?
It's, I mean, I like hearing, I'm not gonna lie, like I got teary-eyed
just like, to hear his voice,
just hearing his voice.
Come on, forget it, how fun is that? That's amazing. That's so great. Oh and, god, all right, I'm sold. I'm gonna watch it. I was gonna watch it anyways, but oh man, I'm really excited to hear T'Challa.
It's really, really, I mean, really just such a, it's so special to hear him in that role. And I just, it really hit, like it hit me. I certainly teared up. Just what a gift he was and is. But it's neat. Like there's a lot of things like where you're like the story is like a thin line kind of thing. But with both of them, there's differences. And then like they start off kind of like subtle differences, and then they just like branch off into like this whole different type of story. And it's really cool. And I remember I liked reading the What If comics growing up. So maybe that's why I'm kind of like,
yeah, they were fun.
A little biased, but
who plays the Watcher?
Jeffrey
Wright.
No, Jeffrey Wright. Yes.
So he was the guy, he was, what's his name in, the James Bond movies.
Oh,
he's the American guy.
I know. Didn't Joe Don Baker play him like in like Pierce Brosnan's version of,
but I don't know, but Jeffrey Wright also plays Commissioner Gordon in the yet to be released The Batman.
Really?
So yeah, he's in the trailer and everything.
So we can add him to Polka Dot Man then.
Yep. He's a man between both worlds.
Ooh, a man between both worlds. I love that. We need to keep that as a running thing.
Absolutely.
What's his? Oh, Felix Leiter.
Yeah, Felix. Yeah. Felix in the James Bond, in the new James Bond iterations. That's Jeffrey. Yeah, and man, he's like this like low key guy and all that. Like, love that. Yeah,
he's awesome. Like,
I am the Watcher.
Every time he, and I'm here to answer the question, what if? So Joe Don Baker plays Jack Wade, who is the CIA American guy who helps James Bond. Pierce Brosnan. That was going to bother the heck out of me.
Oh, okay. what decade was that the movie from?
95.
That's an interesting year, isn't it?
You know, actually, oh man, you just blew my mind right now, Elliot. I was going one way, but you just took it a whole other way, dude.
No. Keep going.
No, I like this way. So 95, man, what a year.
You what know, a like, year.
That was Pierce Brosnan's first turn with the PP7 and GoldenEye.
PP7? What's PP7?
PP7 was James Bond's weapon of choice.
Okay.
But also, two albums by, I would argue, very seminal artists were released.
Seminal,
yes, because they just keep me coming back for more.
Oh no!
So 1995 is a very, very important year. These two artists were, and normally I have like an idea, gentle listener, of like how to like lead into like our album discussion.
Wait, can I hear your idea though?
Well, that's the thing. Like sometimes I have an idea, but other times I'm just winging it, which was going to be like today.
Oh, okay.
I was gonna say something like swallowing it is almost like swallowing a jagged little pill, something like that. You know, like swallowing a
Swallowing.
truth.
Swallowing what? Oh boy.
But like this is too good to not pass up. So for this week's episode, we're talking two albums from the glorious year of 1995, 26 years ago now.
Wait, can we real quick before we dive into it, can we get a here we go?
Oh yeah.
Here we go.
Here we go.
Do I stress you out? My sweater is on backwards and inside out, and you say how appropriate. Today, I don't mean to pick you apart, you see, but I can't help it. And there I go, jumping before the gunshot has gone off. Slap me with the splintered ruler, and it would knock me to the floor if I wasn't there already. If only I could hunt the hunter. And all I really do I wear you out? You must wonder why I'm relentless and all strung out. I'm consumed by the chill of solitary. I'm like Estella. I like to reel it in and then spit it out. I'm frustrated by your apathy. And I am frightened by the corrupted race of this land. If only I could meet the maker. And I am fascinated by the spiritual man. I'm humbled by his humble nature. Yeah. And what I wouldn't give to find a soulmate, someone else to catch this drift.
All right. So for this week's episode, Ellie and I listened to Moby's Everything Is Wrong, released in 1995.
Yeah.
And Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill, released in the same year.
Same year. Same year club. We've done this, I think, a couple times before. I forget which ones. Yeah, but it's
few and far between. Most of the time we're off.
Usually we're way across the spectrum. Yeah, but 95, baby.
And we didn't plan that, actually. Because
no, we didn't.
We don't tell each other what albums we're listening to ahead of time or what we're thinking.
That's one of the rules we don't break on the show, is that we don't tell each other what the next album is.
Yes. As you can hear oftentimes in our either excitement or our general did not see that coming energy that we give off. But yeah, so that's pretty much one of the only rules we have, I think, as far as episode planning. And we love keeping the intro titles off the cuff. That's the other rule. We just never never. But I picked Jagged Little Pill this week because I actually got to see Alanis Morissette in concert last week.
Jake, okay. Tell me what happened. Oh my God.
It was really special, you know?
Yeah.
I was talking to my sister, I was parking and right before I walked into the venue and she was like, are you excited? And I was like, yeah, you know, I mean, gosh, I was so young when Jagged Little Pill came out. Like I can't remember a time in my life when, you know, these songs on this album weren't a part of it. And I said that and I was just kind of like, oh damn, I'm really excited for this, you know, like, because I mean, Alanis Morissette, I mean, she's an icon, you know, she's just all around incredible artist. And so I was excited just for that. But when I realized that I had like some type of like personal connection, as I'm sure, you know, everyone at the concert did, I was just kind of, I sat in my car after we got thrown. I was like, oh, damn, like this is going to be awesome. And it really, really was a special night. Like,
Wait, did you listen to the album on your way there?
I didn't. I wanted to just kind of like go into it like totally like fresh, you know, and just let it like wash over me.
Okay,
And
good. Yeah.
I'm glad I did, because there were like some songs on the album that I kind of forgot were on the album, like Head Over Feet.
Yeah.
The other one was You Learn. Oh man, I forgot how incredible a song You Learn
Woo!
is.
Woo!
And I can remember so clearly, like being a kid, because I mean, not to date myself, but I was like 7 when Jagged Little Pill came out.
7, and you remember it?
Huh?
You at the age of 7, you were like lining up at the record store to get Jagged Little Pill?
No, I just remember the songs on Mix 96.1 in San Antonio.
There you go.
And talk about driving to school earlier when I was missing Pokemon. I can remember hearing these songs on the radio, and like
Yeah.
the line in You Learn, when she's like, "I recommend walking around naked in your
Your
living
living room. Wow.
And I remember being like a kid and being like, she's walking around naked, like
Is that
okay,
allowable? But it's my living room.
exactly.
Yeah.
And it's just so many memories tied to this one.
No shit.
And so like, it was really cool to see, because I mean, as a lover and, you know, admirer of art and music, I know that Alanis is just, she's just one of the greats, you know. But seeing like the emotional connection that she had with so many of her fans, because they would show crowd footage, and there were people crying, you know, like there were people like holding their loved ones and singing, and like with their hands, like trying to like reach her, even though she was on this big stage. Like it was really profound. Like it was just, and it was my second show back since the pandemic started, and so it was a really like powerful night. And she just walked on that stage and just owned it, and just had everyone at that venue just in the, you know, in the palm of her hand, or in her pocket, if you listen to One Hand in Your Pocket.
She had one hand in her pocket and the other hand was being eaten out of by the crowd.
So she had one hand in her pocket and the other one was holding the crowd. So,
Seems to be. Oh, that's so cool.
but I just dived into it, and normally I ask, like, Elliot, what are your earliest memories of Jagged Little Pill?
Earliest memories I think back for this one, like it was always it's one of these other albums that's like kind of always kind of been there, like I've never bought the CD, I never bought the album, I never just had it, I never owned it, I never had it in my car in my 90s, you know, remember those like zip bag like CD sleeve booklet things? I never had it in there.
I still have one.
Of course you do. I've got CDs in my car, but they're always like shoved into my glove box, like I'm a sociopath. It was always just kind of ever present, I guess. And I it was so ever present that therefore I didn't really have an opinion on it. It would be like, oh, it's snowing today. So yeah, I don't really have an opinion on that. I don't know. And I was so far off in my own head, and like by 95 that like I wasn't really like, I guess perhaps paying attention to this album and how gigantic it was. I remember like it being like kind of cool. I dug it more than most shit that was out there. Most shit meaning Radio Dredge or whatever. Like I enjoyed it enough. I was maybe a little back in my head. I was like impressed. Like, wow, this Canadian girl got to like top 40. Like, I don't know. I think like 7 times over on this one album.
It was a
like, big it's massive. And then like revisiting the album, like realizing how truly great it is. It's really fucking great. It's really awesome. And like how many singles on this album are awesome and like what they mean and how like entrenched in the social mire and cultural osmosis of it all, like how they are, these songs are like anchors into that. Like everyone remembers this album, everyone like knows, like if someone makes a joke about Ironic, like don't you think, like bam, people like know what that is. And like that's because this album was so gigantos. It didn't occur to me at the time that it was so big. I fucking love it. It's amazing.
It's a killer one, you know, and it's so, you know, another album that we talked about, Natalie Imbruglia's album from 1997.
Yeah.
You know, I heard a lot of that album, and this is a Sip and Mimos affair. So I'm drawing a blank.
It's okay.
Left of the Middle. Sorry.
Oh, that wow.
That was my album, and I just totally blanked on it. You know,
you could have asked me, and I would have forgotten for you. And you couldn't blame it on me. All
right. You know, so, I mean, Left of the Middle comes out in, like, 97, and I heard a lot of, like, the genesis of that album I heard in this one. And it just made me think, like, how crazy influential this one was, you know? So this album was released in 95, and it was actually released on Madonna's label, Maverick.
Okay.
And it's just it's just crazy. Like it's let me see, let me pull it up. It was nominated for 9 Grammys and won 5, including Album of the Year, which made Alanis Morissette at 21 years old the youngest artist to win that award. And she was only dethroned in like 2008, 2009 by Taylor Swift.
Okay, that's wild. Because I had written down while listening to this, I'm like, would we have Taylor Swift without Alanis? Like, is Alanis a proto Taylor Swift?
No, yeah, absolutely. And it's so funny you said it, because I heard a lot of Taylor in this album.
Yeah. Alanis like really developed this kind of like revenge ballad thing that kind of, for better or for worse, Taylor's kind of known for. Maybe I should asterisk myself, because I don't like that I just said revenge ballad, because that's like a rotten thing to say. Because Alanis is writing things about an ex or exes, seemingly,
okay,
in this album, and in it. Happens to be a fucking masterpiece. So, and then like, but like a lot of people now, modern days, 20 years later, Taylor Swift is like famous for like, oh, if you date her and then she breaks up with you or you guys split, she's going to write a song about you and everyone guesses which song is for who, which guy or whatever the fuck, which is a gross way to approach music, I think, really. So I apologize for framing it in that way, and we'll keep this in the episode, so I had to own it.
What's that great quote from High Fidelity where he's like,
yeah,
am I miserable because I listen to pop music, or do I listen to pop music because I'm miserable? Yeah, no, I think, and I said that Taylor Swift won. So Taylor Swift won it, won Album of the Year. I think she was 20, but it looks like, I just checked on the internet. Thank you, internet. Billie Eilish actually was the youngest to win Album of the Year at 18 years old.
Okay.
What was I doing at 18? waiting for my last growth spurt, maybe.
all I can think of as a father is if you win an album of the year at 18, someone fucked up and you're being manipulated and someone's fucking with you. I'm so bummed out that I think I would go to that immediately, but like, okay, how do I phrase this? Certainly an 18-year-old can make an album that's awesome and should get album of the year. Sure, if it's the album of the year, whatever. Also, I don't care about these award things at all. But
the Grammys are kind of a joke. So,
yeah. But like, if you're 18 and like you win a Grammy, like someone was poking and prodding you the whole time, man. I don't know.
Yeah,
that bums me out.
Because you could write songs about like going out and partying and like, you know, having a good time, and that's great because that's part of the human experience. But also, a really big part of the human experience is being heartbroken.
Yeah,
you know, and being just like absolutely stunned by the love of your life at that point in your life, just walking out and just, you know, giving up on a relationship in your eyes, you know. And I think that's what draws so many people across the generations, decades to music, is that relatability, that, you know, that listening to You Ought to Know, you know, like, and feeling those things, you know, and like having a connection to what this, you know, 19, I think she was 19 when they started writing. That's the other thing. Alanis Morissette wrote this album, you know, like,
let's get into it. Let's get into it. Okay. Tell me everything you know about this album.
Yeah. She wrote the album along with, let me go to the track list. So she wrote the album with a guy named Glenn Ballard. And from what I understand, the two of them just got into the studio and just like started just experimenting with different sounds. And I would argue that this one set up pretty much the rest of the 90s as far as pop music. I mean, you can hear like the wah effect on the guitars. It's just, you know, it's just so familiar. And I heard it listening back to this one and I was just like, oh, like, that's where this comes from, you know. And I think Alanis, like, she brought like this like raw honesty that was maybe like, we talked about Taylor Swift earlier, that was maybe a little bit more polished by the time like Taylor started writing songs. Like, I think their songs are like certainly about the same like subject matter, like going through heartbreak, being young. But I think Taylor Swift is a little bit more like polished, and that might be because of that like Nashville sound that she was working with like Fearless and her self-titled album. But I certainly think a case can be made that you can trace directly like Alanis Morissette to Taylor Swift. Like there's, you know, and I think if you were to ask Taylor if she was a fan, she would say absolutely, definitely.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, and it's this album, like, it talks about like relationships once again, like, which just connects with the listeners, you know, like connects with, you know, she talks about like, I reference You Ought to Know. So it's a song that really, like, when you're so upset and you're so like, you're going through something and you're just like blurting out these thoughts that, in hindsight, you might be like, oh, why was I thinking that, you know? But it captures that in the song to where you're just like, you know, was I not good enough? Like, what is going on? Like, yeah, what's so good about this person? What didn't make me good enough, you know? And it's like, and it's like the lyrics of this one is like almost like a meditation on at the end of a breakup. And I think it's so crazy powerful.
Well, but also, You Ought to Know has this really tasty bass line. Like, did you enjoy those? Because I know you're a bass line guy.
Oh, do you know who played bass on that one?
I don't.
None other than Red Hot Chili Peppers' Flea.
Flea is on You Ought to Know?
Yeah.
No shit.
And Dave Navarro is playing guitar on that one.
Wow! Yeah. I was listening back to it today, and I was like, oh, Jake must love these fucking bass lines. Like, you know, it's different when you listen to it, like, in your car or, like, on, you know, whatever, MTV or VH1 or whatever. But, like, if you're, like, in your head, you're like, there's, like, some really crazy bass line stuff going on there. I'm like, oh, I know Jake's digging that.
Oh, I loved it. Like, and I didn't Jake, realize
that. Jake, are you a guitar player that wishes you was a bass player?
Oh, you know, I remember, like, when I first started, I started off playing guitar. Like, I remember being like, oh man, guitar's so cool. You know, I would, you know, why would I want to, you know, bass? You know, but yeah. As I've grown up and, like, gotten smarter and more wise, I'm like, oh man, bass is where it's at. You know, which shout out to our friend Ruben. Who is an incredibly gifted all-around musician and can play the hell out of a guitar and a bass. So, shout out Ruben.
And drums, by the way.
Oh, and drums. Oh, gosh. And sing. It's just not fair. It's just
not fair. It's not fair. It's not fair.
But no, like, just the lyrics are, like, so smartly written. Like, Hand in My Pocket. Like, it's just... And they're written in such a... Like, I'm brave, but I'm chicken shit. You know, like, stuff. It's just, it's funny and relatable, and she just
yeah, she's funny. She's funny. She's quite the lyricist and quite the vocalist. Holy shit! And then she's also kind of she's funny. She's jabbing at people. I wrote down, like, this could be a battle rap album. Like, this album sounds like a response album to someone else's album. Clearly she's been wronged and she's putting everything she's fucking got into this shit. And she's like, the story is first here. And I think it's astonishing. See right through you. See through you. Sorry. I think it is. Hit me hard. Right through you. The song Right Through You hit me really hard. Like, I know I've heard it before, but, like, man, on this listen, I was like, wow, this one's awesome.
Yeah. After 26 years of hearing those singles, I tried to really focus on, like, the non-singles of the album. And there's Right Through You, Forgiven was another favorite. Wake Up. There's just so much to work with on this album and so much to just enjoy. It was such a treat to listen and discuss this one. I read that she toured on this album for 18 months. And do you want to take a guess who the opening band was on her Jagged Little Pill tour?
What, the one you saw?
Oh no! In the 90s.
In the 90s.
Yeah.
I'll
give you a hint. They dropped an album in 1995 as well, which I did not know.
I don't know.
Radiohead.
Wow. Did Radiohead open up for Alanis?
I believe so.
How about that? Interesting. Do you have, like, a all-time favorite track off this album? Like, all-time? It's hard to pick one, I know. Like, because they're all... Man, the hits off this album just don't stop coming. Like, they're amazing.
I would... The one that... I mean, the one I return to the most is the one we actually haven't talked about. It's got to be Ironic.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So now I have to talk about Ironic. I like it too. Is she describing situations that are truly definitively ironic?
See, that's the thing I've thought about, like, so much with this song. I remember listening to it with my mom and she being like, that's not really ironic.
And you're like, you don't think? And she's like,
I'm like, it's not? Like, what do you mean it's not ironic?
And she's like, well, that's not really ironic that the song is. I'm just like, okay. But then as I got older, I was like, wait a second. Is the song, the subject matter of the song not being ironic make the whole song itself ironic?
Oh. Okay.
Isn't it ironic, don't you think? Yeah, I really do think that the song Ironic is describing situations that aren't actually ironic, but close enough when they're actually kind of happenstance or circumstantial events. But is it ironic, don't you think, that Alanis would get the song, get the meaning wrong? Is that part of a greater message?
I mean,
love that theory. I'm on board with that. I think that's like awesome. Let's go with that.
That's what I've been saying. I mean, it's like, because I mean, this is obviously a very just, very smart person, you know, and like, honestly, like I would not put it past them to be like, you know, I'm going to say this, all this stuff is ironic, but you know what? It's kind of ironic because it's not.
Can I tell you what's not ironic, but it is happenstance. It took me years and years to figure out what Jagged Little Pill, the title of the album, meant.
Oh yeah, because it's kind of recorded kind of low. It's mixed low in the song.
Oh no, I mean the title of the album.
Oh,
Jagged Little Pill. I guess I hadn't been paying attention to the lyrics or anything like that, but like, and then like the album came up years ago and I was like, why is it called that? And then I realized, oh, it's hard to swallow. And I was like, wow, okay, she might be a genius.
Yeah.
And certainly a brilliant and breathtaking lyricist. And I mean, all these poems are beautiful. These are great. Yeah. But I am very embarrassed that it took me so long to figure out what she meant by Jagged Little Pill. You ought to know, like, it's so deep within the social construct that, like, there's a great episode of The Office when Kevin is singing karaoke. Oh. And he's like, you. He says a few too many yous. You. Oh, no. Because he's like going through a breakup or whatever.
I forgot about that.
Oh, man, it's so fun. But that's how ingrained this album is in our culture. It's amazing.
I remember there's an episode of Family Guy did like a spoof of Star Wars. And the Emperor is talking to Stewie, who is playing Darth Vader. And he's just like, I'm emptying out my CD collection. I'm giving away some CDs. I have a Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill. And Stewie's like, no, I won't take that one. And he's just like, are you sure? This is huge, man. This is my 1995 and my 1996. You don't want this? And he's like, no, thank you.
This is my 1995 and my 1996. I love that. That's great. Oh, man, forget it.
Everything she sung about was everything she sung about was just so, like, you know, relatable. And you know, because
you live, you learn. Do you know the rumors about who Jagged Little Pill is about?
Okay.
Or should we not even talk about it, because maybe that's rude to talk about?
Well, someone
you've heard this, then you've heard it.
Yes.
Okay.
Is it it's not Uncle Joey.
Yeah. No, it
the
is.
The other, who?
Yeah. It's Dave Coulier.
Dave Coulier. Because they dated before, right? Like,
from what I understand, a lot of people talk about this, and I don't know, and I don't know if Alanis said anything, but, and we'll cut this out, if this is gross to say. I feel gross now, but say everything is wrong again. but the rumor is that this album is about their relationship, and like she went down on him in the theater and blah, blah, blah and all that.
Really?
That's what the room, that's what people are saying on the internet 20 years ago, last time I looked at the internet.
You know, that's one of those things where I only know him as, no, it is Uncle Joey. And then Stamos played Jesse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I only know him as like goofy Uncle Jesse who likes the rabbit, you know? And I just.
Joey.
Uncle Joey, sorry. To each their own. I mean, if their relationship, you know, I it's sad that relationships have to end, but I mean, it created, you know, a work of art that stands the test of time and still influences people to this day. So I mean,
do you think Alanis, if this whole album, this amazing album, is about Dave Coulier, do you think she owed it to him to let him know that it was going to come out and change the world?
No, because I when it's being created, I believe art belongs to the artist. You know, I believe art is an individual's interpretation of emotion in a physical, viewable, tasteable question mark, audible medium, or whatever, which way you create art. I think it's like an interpretation of like feelings. Mm-hmm. And I think art belongs to the artist. And I think those emotions are theirs to process in any which way they can. Cause I mean, everyone's different in their own way. Like sometimes going through heartbreak, you hit the gym, you know, and like get ripped, or you learn a new hobby. Sometimes you just create, you know, groundbreaking art, groundbreaking albums, you know. It's just,
yeah.
I don't know if it's owed to anyone.
So it's, yeah, it is an odd thing. And I think I'm with you. Most of art belongs to the artist, but everyone's allowed to interpret it in different ways, of course. And then it becomes within the eye of the beholder. But it's a real tense, strenuous thing where would you take away the bad feelings that Alanis had that led her to make this, like in a perfect world, you know, like in a perfect world, she would not have had this struggle, and then therefore not have made this album that we all appreciate. Yeah. And it's almost as if, like, you know, if we can create things out of, you know, like we talked about last time with Elliott Smith and all this, like, it just seems to me like if we can make something beautiful out of the fact that everything is wrong.
Oh, damn it. And then that's what it's all about. Thank you. it's interesting. And I think this next album we're getting ready to talk about is also a very emotional, very expressive album.
Expressive.
Expressive might be like the best word I would say, but
I like that.
It was something I was not expecting from this artist. Elliot, would you like to introduce this week's artist for you?
Yeah, since we started the show, Jake's been asking me about like almost since we started the show, like, when are we going to get to Moby? And yeah, I think we've said WWE Moby Play. Moby Play is the big album that came out in 99, where every single track on there was utilized to like car commercials and TV shows and movies and all this. But it also was like Moby's big hit that like just touched perfectly. And it kind of blew everyone away and was amazing. But I wanted to go back a little bit to the 95 Moby, Everything Is Wrong. And this album's a little interesting or maybe less than interesting, in that it's so disjointed. He's got ambient tunes on here where it's just him and a piano and a synth pad. He's got punk rock tunes on here where he's like playing thrash metal. He's got a few really great dance tunes on here. He has a tune on here that's like a high speed drum and bass tune, which I adore. But I like all the tunes in a different kind of way. I'm not a big fan of his thrash shit. I did not talk about Moby as an artist and this album, which is kind of weird. It's a weird album. That's why I wanted to talk about it before we can just gush about Play, which is truly brilliant. But I think this is Moby trying to figure out where he goes. He had been established earlier in the 90s with a song called Go that sampled the theme from Twin Peaks, and it became a big dance hit. And he's like, oh my god, I should abandon my punk rock roots that he had. And he moved into like dance music and just kind of blew the hell up. And so eventually he puts out this album, Everything Is Wrong. It's just so back and forth. We open with him. We go immediately into Feeling So Real, which is one of my favorite tunes of Moby's, truly, which is high speed, high energy, dance floor euphoria. And it's an odd, I talk a lot on this show about like track order and everything. And this one is way out of balance. I'll absolutely admit that. But it is a collection of tunes that showcases this dude's mind in a certain era, 1995, and what has been quite formative and quite informative in the decade and will continue to be so. But you have this right in the middle of the 90s, 1995. Here's where Moby is at, and he's doing a little bit of everything, which doesn't seem to work out ultimately, but man, is he good at most of these things. And he's a beautiful pianist. He knows melody, he knows all this. He seems to have an idea of what like the dance scene is about, these raves and all this. So he starts making these dance tunes that blow the hell up. And he releases this album, Everything Is Wrong. The weird thing about Moby is that in the rave community, the idea is that when you go into these parties and you hear this kind of music, the kind of feelings you're supposed to feel is everything is fine. Everything is great. Everything is beautiful. It's euphoric. But he's putting out an album with these songs in it saying everything is wrong. We're doing it wrong. Which seems, it's a little like, I don't know, a snake biting its tail kind of thing, where he's part of it and he's making these euphoric house and speed garage tunes, these piano rave anthems and then saying, I'm doing this the wrong way. It seems to be confessional almost. Like, I don't like that I'm doing this. But also within this album, we hear these synth pads show up that eventually mature a few years later into his biggest album ever. And he changes the landscape of things. Jake, what'd you think of Moby's Everything Is Wrong?
It was at times like almost like a jarring listening experience. But not like necessarily in like a bad way, because I mean, as we've established on our show, you know, I grew up listening to a ton of metal. I still listen to metal, and so like the, let me pull up the track list. So like the songs on the album, like is it What Love, the real heavy one? Yeah, how it starts off with going down to see my love.
Yeah.
I heard that one started off, and I was thinking like, oh, this sounds like what he did famously on Play. The song just like erupts into this like thrash, kind of like hardcore guitar, really buzzy guitar driven song, which I did not see coming, especially after hearing a song like Bring Back My Happiness, which is very, very dancey, very...
Well, here's what happens.
I don't think we talked about raves all that much. I know like that culture was like a big part of like the 90s electronica. Was he big in like the rave scene?
He was, after he was big in the punk scene. So in this, and he said like this album was like him trying both. But man, it makes for a really, and I'm with you, like it's a herky jerky kind of album, right?
Yeah.
Like it's a breakneck, emotional whiplash kind of album where, like, you know, you open with him, this beautiful piano thing, you open, it then goes into Feeling Surreal, which is like a 160 BPM dance tune. And then, like, beyond that, we get into like a punk rock thing. Is he just like, showcasing like this is the stuff I'm into, and yeah, it's just him showcasing the stuff he's into. But like that's not a cohesive album. But nevertheless, the like, songs on here are very well done. Yeah, I think Moby eventually got away from his like punk roots because like he's like, oh, I don't think I'm good at this. One thing with didn't truly. One thing Moby like figured out early on is like, oh, I'm not a good singer, and it's like I shouldn't be singing. And then it was like, well, Jimi Hendrix wasn't necessarily a good singer, all that, but like I don't know, I'll just do my punk rock shit when I sing. And then he has this like weird obsession with Lou Reed, I believe, where you get the slide guitar, the wah-wah that we heard a lot on Alanis and all that, the wow-wow, the slide guitar stuff, where he brings back when in Play with Southside and all that. He really wants to be able to play slide guitar like Lou Reed. And he famously covers Lou Reed every fucking show he plays. Well,
like, that's one of the things, like, so I, and I want to give the author credit, but I started reading a book a while back, right before school started, so I didn't get to finish it. But it was a book about like the late 90s, early aughts music scene, rock and roll, electronic music scene in New York. And it's called Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth in Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. And it's by author Lizzie Goodman. And Moby's actually featured in there. And I guess I didn't realize that Moby's just like, he's so closely associated to New York. Like, he's like a New York guy. And when I was reading about him, because I didn't know a terrible amount about Moby, just aside from like Play and like You're All Made of Stars, that song he followed up Play with.
Oh, yeah.
Which is good. But I mean, Play was just a monster. But on the album, it says that he wrote most of the album while living in his apartment on like Mott Street.
Yeah,
is Mott Street like a famous place in New York? I don't know.
No, I mean no. from what I understand, I think it's in the East Village. I'm sure fans will correct me if I'm wrong. He's a New Yorker for sure.
Manhattan, in
Lower East Manhattan, yes. And he has an apartment there, and apparently they say recorded this album there, but I would say perhaps finalized is a better word for it, as in like file save.
Yeah.
Zip, here's the album. Because, come on. But, there's great stories of people bumping into Moby. Like in New York, he lives there, of course. He has a tea shop there called Teany, Teany, you know, Teany. I've had a tea there before. And I've bumped into Moby a couple of times. He's a guy with something to say, and boy oh boy does he say it. Like so this gets us to where the liner notes of it all. So at this point, like Moby is now like realizing like, oh, he's a beyond a musician, he is a activist. So he's going to he's like, how can I, if people bought my album, how could they know how I feel about this stuff? And so he starts writing these essays and shoving them into his liner notes. Like, instead of like, you know, saying like, oh, here's, you know, you take the liner notes out of a CD or an album, like, oh, here's the lyrics, here's the credits or whatever. It's it's Moby's essays on veganism, animal rights, and all this. And it gets to be like, because who isn't for that? So it's hard to be like, shut the fuck up, Moby. I love listening to Porcelain while I eat my chicken nuggets. It's more like, yeah. It's more like Jesus. Like maybe, I don't know. Cause I'm not going to tell any artists what to do.
He's, he's obviously a legend, you know, like he's highly influential and just like one of those like game-changing electronic artists. Because I mean, and I keep on referencing it, but I'm sorry, but like I cannot say how big and like present Play was for so many years. Like it was everywhere.
Yeah,
you know, it was on commercials, movies, just everything. And so like, do you think at this point like Moby the activist is kind of like overshadowing Moby the artist?
I would say, well, I guess I would have to say yes, only because his next album after this is called Animal Rights, I think, and it's just thrash metal.
Thrash metal?
Yeah. And like and he loses all his fans. People are like, this isn't Moby, what the fuck? He's like, no, this is my roots and shit like that. And everyone hates it, so he goes away for a long time. He writes his fucking essays, he makes his tea parlor. Moby's a tricky one because he's so influential, I guess. Oh boy. Okay, as a dance music aficionado, it's tricky to talk about Moby, I guess.
But maybe he is for introducing so many to this genre of music. Like he was like the entry point maybe for like young aspiring electronic musicians in the 90s.
Perhaps. Maybe I could break it down like this. Often electronic music is very masked and underground and invisible. So we're talking aliases for different releases. We're talking, no one knows who really put this out, but it sounds like this person. Aphex Twin, super mysterious. Daft Punk, put the helmets on. And all this. And then there's Moby, who's like, here's who I am. I like thrash metal, veganism, and animal rights. And if you don't like it, buckle up, buckaroos, because I'm going to tell you all about it. And it kind of became like this thing where he put himself before in front of his music a bit more than what the electronic music culture had done in the past. So he's like, I'm in the forefront of this. I am Moby. Here's what I think about things. And also, here's my music. I know you already like it because my albums are selling. Here's who I am. You have to listen to this. You have to buy a timeshare before you get the ski for free. Kind of that. And I think that turned a lot of electronic musicians off of his kind of just vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very ideological.
Ideological. Yeah.
Yeah. There were some really just great, dance. I feel like some like trance stuff on here.
Yeah.
Just the last two tracks, God Moving Over the Face of the Waters, and When It's Cold, I'd Like to Die, featuring the vocals of, want to give them credit because they're really good, Mimi Geese or Ghosts, I apologize.
Ghosts, I
think. Just some really, really good ambient electronic music, but then like you can tell like he's just like, now this is what I like you said, and it's just it does make for a real kind of jarring listen.
It's so up and down. Like, oh my god.
Yeah, like I thought like I had like queued up some stuff before. Like when you queue up, it'll play it in it, even if you put something else, it'll still play your queue. I looked at my phone and I was just like, nope, that's Moby. Okay, we're doing this.
Wow. Yeah.
But no, it was really neat to hear this guy's early work. I think we're both on the same boat. That it's kind of like a mismatch at times of material.
Yeah. Well, I think on purpose, but like, I don't know, experiment failed. Wouldn't it be cool if I made an album where every other track is a completely different genre? Like, that's a cool idea, but it doesn't make for a good sit and listen, I'm with you there. However, there are some fucking jams on here.
Yeah.
And some actual classics. And we're also seeing Moby, like, form his main form. He's slowly getting to his, while he's doing this collection of songs, he's working on his ambient works, and he's building up to Play, where he is now finalized and he is fucking Voltron Moby and knows exactly what he wants to do. He's like, okay, my voice isn't good. Thrash metal, I'm not good at. People don't like it. What I'm good at is playing the piano and building these synth waves. I'm going to find old records. I'm going to sample them, much like my predecessors and people at the time. And I'm going to make something that will certainly sell Chevrolets. And that's Play.
it'll sell Colin Farrell, Kiefer Sutherland movies.
Well, it'll also, did Jake, oh, I hope you recognize. Did you listen to first Cool High on this album?
I hearted this one.
Okay. It is the song that closes out the movie Scream.
Really?
Yep.
I didn't pick up. I guess I haven't seen Scream in a while. I haven't picked up on that one.
Like Orbital's Halcyon before it, and Mean Girls, and Mortal Kombat. First Cool Hive closes out the movie Scream.
Wow. Well, I guess because Scream came out in 95, didn't it? 96. Speaking of Neve, if you're listening,
Neve.
We are
Neve.
isn't it Neve?
No, it's Nev, is it not?
Okay, we'll edit that out. Speaking of, Nev, if you're listening, we do have our Halloween show coming up in about a month. We'd love to have you on. We'll send you the album list. I know our schedules haven't been able to match up, but we are still waiting to start our never-ending story with Nev Campbell. So please shoot us an email. Yeah. Nemospod@gmail.com. We can't wait to have you on.
Oh, come on, Nev. Just head us up. Don't make me slide into your DMs. it sure would be great to have Nev comment on. Yeah, I don't know anything. Okay.
if we had Nev Campbell on here, it would 100% be that like that Chris Farley Paul McCartney skit on SNL, and he was like,
You remember in Scream?
Do you remember when you were with Tim Oliphant? That was awesome.
I'll take the bullet. I'll be like, do you remember Wild Things when I couldn't make it to the rest of the movie?
Oh god.
I'll jump on that grenade for you, man. Even though you watched it at 10 in the morning. Boom!
I'll never live that one down.
It's so funny to me. It's so funny.
Do you remember when you were in The Craft?
Okay. Well, okay. Yes. I was going to ask you, like, let's get back on the Nev train, because I do miss talking about Nev Campbell, and I want to get her on the show.
Nev Campbell, we need to get you on this fall for sure. It's going to be great. Nev Campbell and the Never Ending Story with Sip and Mimos. 100%.
Yeah. Closing thoughts on anything you have to say? You seem a little underwhelmed by Everything Is Wrong.
No, I mean, it's
okay.
I think one of the things that like I've come, and it's kind of you touched on it, where it was just like how our electronic albums flowed. You know, there was like there was a theme. You know, and this one just kind of
no flow.
Yeah, very very little flow, very
disparate.
Perfect word.
Yeah. Oh, and to close out, from what I understand, Moby's a complete fucking prick.
Oh.
From what I understand.
That's unfortunate.
It is, isn't it? Isn't it unfortunate? Is Moby, if you're listening, don't you think? Oh, yeah! Okay, we found out. Wait, not what ironic is. Moby, the most gentle little vegan activist, artist is like actually a fucking piece of shit. All right.
And that actually Moby, is ironic.
It is ironic. Don't you think? Yeah, I really do think. A little too ironic?
Yeah, like unfortunately ironic.
Yeah, I really do think. It's like riot! Okay.
So, you know, you brought it to my... I came on here like kind of like locked and loaded with one, but you brought it to my attention. And I saw it online this morning that we're... A year ago, we did our very special soundtrack episode.
Are you going to soundtrack me, bro?
I think I'm going to soundtrack you.
Okay. Hit me.
Do you have one in mind?
No, just go. Just go and I'll figure one out.
Okay, so this one is... Okay, it is available. Okay, cool.
Available?
Yeah, because so many soundtracks are like only available on like playlists and stuff. Mm-hmm. This one is one of my all-time faves in 90s soundtracks, and there are many of them. It actually features a couple artists that we've actually talked about before on the show, specifically Blink-182 and Eve 6.
Okay.
And but you also have a lot of really great stuff on there. You've got The Replacements singing the title track. You've got Paradise City.
Busta Rhymes, Smash Mouth, and a band that I've been dying to get on this podcast.
Smash Mouth. Okay.
So with that, I would like to submit, humble listeners and my co-host, 1998's Can't Hardly Wait. You might remember this as the movie that stars Jennifer Love Hewitt, Seth Green.
Uh-huh.
And I'm drawing a blank. I don't want to get their name wrong. Peter Facinelli.
Uh-huh.
And the guy, he plays the main guy. Ethan Embry, 1998, Can't Hardly Wait.
The soundtrack to Can't Hardly Wait.
Oh, yeah. You're going to get some Guns N' Roses, Busta Rhymes. It's a fun time.
Okay. All right. I didn't see. This is okay. You, listeners, sometimes Jake likes to throw me a curveball. I thought Ozzy was a curveball, but this is a curveball. But you know what? I'm a better catcher than I am pitcher. What? I shouldn't have said that.
That's a good sticker. We should remember that one.
But I know how to. I know what he's saying. I know what he's thinking, and I'm three steps ahead because I'm going to ask Jake to listen to 1996's soundtrack to the motion picture Trainspotting.
Oh man.
The soundtrack opens up with Iggy Pop and David Bowie's Lost for Life, and then takes you on a journey. And I can't wait to talk about it with you.
Saving it right now. Should I watch this movie before the episode? Will it enhance the listening experience, you think?
From where I'm sitting for the show, you should listen to the soundtrack once through and then watch the movie. And I'll watch Can't Hardly Wait. and then we'll meet back here.
Man, I'm just looking at this one. You got Brian Eno, New Order, aforementioned Lou Reed. Your Underworld makes an appearance on this one.
Okay. See, Underworld, our episode on Underworld, I told you that fans would be upset that he didn't involve the track Born Slippy. And this is the song that is featured heavily in Trainspotting. So this is, we're just like, we just got two dope soundtracks.
I mean, I think we've talked about on an episode before, I'm a Ewan McGregor head, you know, and so any chance to talk about him in any form is very exciting. And Trainspotting is one of those movies where it's always on like those lists of must-sees. So this is the kick in the pants that I need. To dive in.
So you've never seen it?
I've never seen it. I've seen the toilet scene, the nastiest toilet in, is it? Are they in Scotland?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, they're Scottish. It's sad to be in Scottish. That's the second worst scene. So just know that. You'd be okay.
And we like bounced around. We've been like texting, but we're getting ready to enter the fall months, and yeah. I think you know, Ellie and I, one of our favorite holidays is certainly Halloween. So maybe we got some fun things coming down the pipe. Maybe some movie discussion. Certainly, I'm pushing for just an audio reenactment of Bram Stoker's Dracula, just as an episode. Just do it just real ASMR style, you know.
Okay.
I could do that one solo. It'll just be me just doing like all the parts. It's okay if you want. Oh, so.
I want to hear that, honestly. But okay. We could do it. We could do a audio play if you like, or it could just be you.
But we're definitely we'll talk about that more next time. But be on the lookout for that. It sounds like we had a lot of really. We had a lot of listeners for last week's episode on
yes,
Elliot Smith and the Avalanches. So if you're just coming to Sip Mimos and you really enjoyed last week's episode, thank you so much for listening.
Elliot shared that news with me, and I just was so happy and just excited. So they say like labor of love, but this is in no way a labor. This is just nothing but, you know, fun for Elliot and I. So the fact that we have people tuning in and listening, and Elliot said he has a friend in Australia named
Lauren.
Lauren, thank you for listening. Hello. Thank you for your notes on the avalanches.
And
I thought they were fantastic. So wherever you are, however you're listening to the Mimos, thank you so much. It truly is the best feeling in the world. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. This is fun for me and Jake, and like for people to actually be listening, it's like so exciting, and that's pretty cool. It's not, you know, it's a labor of joy, I guess you could call it. So because it's so much fun, and I hope you guys are all along with us on this trip of listening to stuff you may have heard before, but like, or you're revisiting or discovering for the first time.
I think like one of the things that like I love most about this adventure is that, you know, I'm trying to like recreate that feeling of like meeting up with a friend and like just talking about like an album that you really enjoy and that you think your friend would enjoy, you know, like, and I think it's trying to like create that same sensation, which is one of my faves, you know. So and there's certainly movie talk and TV talk, and so happy that, you know, we have some folks out there listening to us. So thank you again, and definitely like and subscribe on iTunes.
Yeah.
If you have any suggestions, leave us a comment, shoot us an email, sippinmimospod@gmail.com, and
follow us on Instagram.
Oh yeah, we're on the Instagram.
I guess that helps.
I'll share some Alanis Morissette videos from the concert last week.
Oh yeah. I was gonna say you better start dropping stuff on the IG, bro. But yeah, like and
hear me subscribe sobbing in the background.
yeah. Okay, so all right, next week we have.
Next week we've got we're mismatching years, but it's okay. We've got 1996's Trainspotting, which I cannot wait.
All right.
And 1998's Can't Hardly Wait. It's going to be so good.
That sounds like a fun episode, man.
Man. All right. For Sippin' Mimos, I'm Jake.
I'm Elliot. And I'm Elliot.
Stay sippin'.
Stay sippin'.
Clink.
Clink.